You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The framers of the Constitution understood that maintaining its system of checks and balances would not be easy. When Benjamin Franklin was asked in 1787 what he and his fellow delegates at the convention had wrought, a republic or a monarchy, he replied, "A republic, if you can keep it." In Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror, Frederick A.O. Schwartz, Jr. and Aziz Z. Huck argue that the Bush administration has claimed authority under the Constitution to set aside laws permanently that were intended to check executive power. Their book is published by the New Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Schwartz and Mr. Huck to the show today. Hello.
We're pleased to be here.
Very pleased.
Hasn't there always been a tug of war over presidential powers, and some of our greatest presidents involved Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, FDR, I think it was Mencken, who asked why we didn't simply crown him king?
There has always been a tug of war, but and Lincoln is a good example of that tug of war. But Lincoln was totally different than the current administration, because when he took unilateral action to suspend habeas corpus, he went to Congress and said, "I've done this, and you can either attack me or you can support me," and they ended up ratifying what he did. And there have been, during times of crisis, Franklin Roosevelt, you know, locked up Japanese, West Coast Japanese in concentration camps. But what's different now is that the government actually claims a right to break the law. And that's new, and it's very dangerous.
And why? Under what grounds do they claim the right to break the law? Is break the law something you're saying, or is break the law something that anybody, Republican or Democrat, would say if he or she was being totally objective about it?
Let me take the second half of your question, and the Z's do the first half, what their theory is. But I think any objective person would say that they are putting forward a theory that they can break the law. And the wiretapping, the restraints that were put in after the Church Committee, where I was the chief counsel, that limited wiretapping in the United States to wiretapping with a warrant. And they took the position that we can ignore that.
And I think that the best example or the best way of seeing this is really by comparing what Lincoln did with what we've seen in the last 5 years. At the beginning of the Civil War, Lincoln took a series of measures without congressional approval. He suspended habeas corpus. He arrested people. And these were all measures that were clearly beyond the powers that he'd been granted as president by Congress. But after he'd taken those powers, he went back to Congress and said, "I've done these things. Please ratify my authority now." He didn't try and hide them. He didn't claim that they were permanent features of the presidency. What's happened today is rather than claiming emergency powers solely in the context of a time-bound emergency, we've seen a claim that the president, in the name of national security, can set aside laws that are meant to guide and channel national security powers. Those laws set aside permanently on an ongoing basis.
Well, some people would say I'm perfectly happy to give up some of my rights as a result of 9/11, at least temporarily, until we resolve this problem. But the record indicates that that something else is going on here, doesn't it? Vice President Cheney has said, "In 34 years, I have repeatedly seen an erosion of the powers and the ability of the President of the United States to do his job." And so this is, does this really grow out of the thinking of Dick Cheney and some others that things that the Church Committee and some other things that were done by Congress threw things out of balance and now
yes,
they have to be redressed?
Cheney, way back, right after Watergate, his reaction to Watergate was to say we should reduce oversight by Congress and the courts. And then he wrote a dissent from the Congressional Iran-Contra report, where he talked about the ability of a president to break the law. So this has been a long-standing view of Dick Cheney, and I think he, powerful in the administration as he is, took advantage of 9/11 to press his ideological position on enhancing the power of the presidency.
Jane Mayer wrote a piece in The New Yorker called The Hidden Power, in which she said that it was a man named David S. Addington, Dick Cheney's chief of staff and his longtime legal advisor, who has been instrumental in arguing that the Constitution gives the president the authority to disregard virtually all legal boundaries if national security demands it.
And Addington was really key in the writing of the minority report that Fritz just referred to. You know, one thing that's worth bearing in mind is that just as much as this is not about 9/11, there isn't a simple trade-off between security and liberties. It's not as if you give up checks and balances, it necessarily makes you safer. And one of the really interesting things to emerge out of the Church Committee's findings is that when you take away accountability, when you take away congressional oversight, when you take away either legal checks beforehand or accountability after the fact, what you get is intelligence powers straying from legitimate targets out into a whole slew of far less legitimate targets.
My guests are Frederick A. O. Schwartz. Well, first, Aziz Z. Huck, who was just talking, associate counsel at the Brennan Center and previously a clerk on the U.S. Supreme Court, and Frederick A. O. Schwartz, Jr., senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law and a partner at Kravath, Swain and Moore. He was chief counsel to the Church Committee. So let's go back to the Church Committee. It followed Watergate, but a lot of other things that people have been concerned about. COINTELPRO at the FBI, the FBI's bugging of Martin Luther King Jr., investigations of people, wiretapping and the sort that nobody knew was happening. That seems still a lot worse than what we're seeing today.
Well, I don't think so, because I think today we are injuring the United States in a way that hasn't been done before, because we're hurting the reputation of the United States enormously, and we're giving ammunition to our foes, and we're undermining our allies by what's going on today. Now, what the Church Committee did reveal was very, very, very troubling, and we showed that from Franklin Roosevelt through Richard Nixon, every president had abused their national security powers. And this book spends the first 10% or so teaching the lessons or recounting the lessons of the Church Committee and then trying to apply them today.
So this has been something that, this, as I said earlier, is a tug of war that's been going on for a long, long time between presidents and Congress and the courts. But what do constitutional experts say? Has anybody been consulted about, let's say, David Addington's views that I quoted earlier?
Well, these are really views that have very little currency within the legal academy. And there is, though, a small coterie of lawyers and law professors who aggressively promote a vision of executive power that is on par with what the vice president has been pushing for the last 20 years. And it's that coterie that have made it that were explicitly hired and played the leading role in elaborating legal opinions that form the basis of policies around torture, policies around the abrogation of the Geneva Conventions, which are rules that govern our conduct in wartime, and policies around warrantless surveillance, the controversy over the National Security Agency. Those views, although they don't have much currency in the academy, now have the possibility of getting entrenched in the fabric of the executive order, that once powers that are used once are very hard to give up.
I think the chapter 7 in our book, which is called Kings and Presidents, I think lays out the flaws in the Cheney and Bush administration theories better than has ever been done anywhere else. And I think it's speaking as a person who understands the Constitution, I think the showing that their theory being deeply flawed is more completely done in that Chapter 7 than anywhere else.
Well, some of the people who were involved in formulating this policy are under fire right now for very different reasons. But the Office of Legal Counsel issued a memo declaring that the president had inherent constitutional authority to take whatever military actions he deemed necessary, not just in response to 9/11, but in the prevention of future attacks. And that has opened up many possibilities for now, this administration.
The one memo that's been most widely seen is their memo saying the president has the right to torture people, even though there's both a treaty and a law, a U.S. law, that say the U.S. may not use torture. So the question is nicely posed by the subject of torture. It's not been in America's interest to use torture, by the way. One of the reasons we're in the Iraq War is because of false information that was provided to Egyptian people who tortured a person that was sent to Egypt by the Americans that claimed that there was a connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. But before the Bush administration used that false information obtained by torture, the administration had been advised that it was unreliable.
Well, haven't people argued that any information obtained through torture is unreliable because as you're pulling out someone's fingernails, they're very likely to say whatever you want them to say?
That's not a position that this administration has hewed to. What they say is that the use of coercive techniques gains better information than you would get without it. The problem with that position, quite apart from the fact that Congress has spoken unequivocally, that the international community also has spoken unequivocally that torture is prohibited in all circumstances. Quite apart from that problem, when you torture somebody, it may be that you get true information, but you have no way of sifting what is true from what is false. And as Fritz explained, that's been a problem with key information on which military actions have been based. It will continue to be a problem as long as the policies that are justified by this theory of unchecked executive power are still in place. And they still are in place. The same torture or the same interrogation protocols that were permitted by the 2002 Justice Department memo are still lawful under internal Justice Department legal interpretations.
Is this something that Congress can have any say in? After all, the Church Committee changed the law. It led to a change of laws after the Nixon presidency.
Well, the first place, the Congress has the power to control this situation. When you look at the Constitution, it's clear that Congress has the greater power. They often choose not to use it, and I think it's fair to say that Congress, more often than not, has chosen not to use its powers.
Although when Congress does pass laws, sometimes the president counters with a signing statement, and we'll come back with that and more after we take a little break. My guests are Frederick A.O. Schwartz, Jr., a senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. He was chief counsel for the Church Committee. Also was the head lawyer for New York City and for many years a partner in a leading New York law firm. I don't know what he would say about the city's police investigations that have become a big issue in the news. Also here is Aziz Zihuk, H-U-Q, who directs the Liberty and National Security Project at the Brennan Center. He's a 2006 Carnegie Scholars Fellow, previously clerk for the U.S. Supreme Court. They have collaborated on a book called Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror, and the book is published by The New Press. Stay with us. We're back with Frederick A.O. Schwartz, Jr. and Aziz Zihuk, who've collaborated on a book called Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror, published by the New Press. The part two of your book is titled Adopting Tactics of the Enemy. Are we talking about torture and the like there?
Yes, we are. And we notice we didn't say the tactics of the enemy because obviously our policies do not pale in comparison to the policies and actions of al-Qaeda. But nonetheless, America has adopted policies like torture, which hurt us enormously in terms of reputation, both with friends and with foes.
But we've been talking about usurpation of power by the executive branch. Didn't Congress grant a lot of those powers when it passed the Patriot Acts 1 and 2?
One of the surprising things about the Patriot Act is that if you trace back the problematic powers of interrogation, surveillance, and detention that we've seen play out post 9/11 in immigration, in overseas detention, in spying here, virtually none of them, with one or two exceptions, derived from the Patriot Act. In almost every case, the problematic policies were ones that were generated within the executive branch, really without any external consultation.
But didn't the Patriot Act authorize torture in some instances, extraordinary rendition, secret prisons?
No.
None of that?
Considering the Patriot Act cuts against the position of the administration because they had a chance to argue in favor of these things like torture and rendition and warrantless wiretapping, and they explicitly chose not to. And indeed, on warrantless wiretapping, they did other things to somewhat smooth the passage of an approval for wiretapping. So the inference one would get from reading the Patriot Act is they weren't going to do something on warrantless wiretapping or torture. And of course, they were not willing to publicly admit that they were going to go around torturing people because it doesn't sound like something which is consistent with America's history.
And
of course, another good example of that is the policy of extraordinary rendition, which is when people are picked up by the United States and handed over to a third country like Egypt and Syria, where we know that they will be tortured for information. The Patriot Act was being written in September and October of 2001. At the same time, on September the 17th, 2001, the president signed what's called a presidential decision directive, which is a classified order from the president to the CIA, which authorized the extraordinary rendition program. So these things are going on in parallel, but the problematic policies are all going on behind closed doors.
But the argument that we get from the administration is that if all of these things were made public, then we would be alerting the enemy to our tactics.
Well, if you say it's dangerous to tell the enemy that we're torturing people, that's not a tactic. That's a choice. And it's a choice which John McCain has condemned. It's a choice which the British House of Lords have condemned. And it's a choice which is used against us in propaganda by horrible organizations like Al-Qaeda, where they're saying, what's the difference between and Zimbabwe, similarly, which is a dictatorial African regime at the verge of chaos, defends their locking up political opponents by saying, well, the United States disappears people today also.
Have we gotten any real solid results from all of these tactics? I mean, we just recently had a major confession by someone who political cartoonist now, joking,
right,
is even confessing
to betting. Red Sox. Yeah. I think it's very hard to judge the results of these specific tactics, the interrogation, the detention tactics. It's certainly the case that some of the people who have been picked up around the world are really threats and really should have been picked up. But do we get more out of somebody like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed by locking them up in secret for 4 years, by parading a confession that immediately provokes ridicule around the world because it's clear that, first of all, he's not responsible for these 30 things, as awful as the things that he has done, and that immediately strikes people as being the product of torture. It's not clear to me that we're better off taking that road than we are bringing him before a fair trial and showing to the world that American justice is morally better than the kind of quote unquote justice that people like KSM would want to mete out.
One of the people who was convicted of the crimes that Now, Khalid, what's his name? Khalid Mohammed?
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has claimed, says, well, you should free me because he says he did it, I didn't do it.
That's right. And the government's going to have a really interesting set of problems now that KSM has confessed pretty much to everything on the books when they bring forward their cases against other terrorists.
You wanted to say something, Fran?
No, it wasn't important.
Well, so here we have Robert Gates saying, let's get us out of Guantanamo, and the administration ignoring him, even though they brought him in at defense to clean up a mess that Donald Rumsfeld had left. In the end, are we stuck with some of the things we did because the alternative, if we move away from Guantanamo, then we're going to pretty much have to free everybody when they become subject to a whole other set of rules?
I don't think that's true. I don't think the choice that we have is really that stark. I think Guantanamo should be closed because Guantanamo has become a symbol around the world of everything that has gone wrong, every hypocrisy with American policy. But that doesn't mean that there aren't people at Guantanamo who legitimately can be held as prisoners of war. The law of war allows people to be picked up on a battlefield if they're carrying a gun, firing at American soldiers, and held for the duration of the conflict. And certainly those people should be detained. What we need at Guantanamo, what we need on many of these policies, is a thorough disinfecting airing, a public airing of what has happened and what the facts are.
Another point is that's important is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is clearly a bad and dangerous person. He was definitely involved and probably inspired the World Trade horror. But there are other people who were picked up in Guantanamo who were there because the United States was offering bounties for anyone who was brought forward or were picked up for reasons that have proven that are clearly not valid. And the problem with Guantanamo is that the distinction is not drawn between the people who are definitely and clearly bad people and other people who are innocent but are being kept because it's the government finds it embarrassing to admit that they picked up a lot of people who weren't problems.
And why did they do that? They did what Fritz described because, as Jane Mayer has explained in the article that you referred to, because the administration wanted to prove a point. They wanted to prove the point that they could pick up people, and they didn't need to follow the Geneva Conventions, which requires that you have a hearing, which requires that you sort the innocent shepherd from the Taliban fighter. They said, we're not going to do that because we're going to prove that we don't have to follow the rules.
My guests are Aziz Z. Huck and Frederick A.O. Schwartz, Jr. Their book, Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror, published by the New Press. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Aziz, what about the courts? The courts have made decisions that have cut both ways, but they don't seem to have had very much effect.
That's right. You've seen a set of decisions around, particularly around detention, and now you're starting to see a set of decisions around surveillance. But courts in wartime have a very hard road to hoe if they want to really push back against the executive. And an example of that is the Supreme Court's decision in 2006 to shut down the military commissions and to impose basic standards, what are called common Article 3 standards, which are the minimum standards that humanitarian law requires, on the treatment of all prisoners. What the executive did in response to that is to go around the court. They went to Congress. They pushed immediately in the run-up to an election to overturn, to overwrite several critical aspects of that Supreme Court decision from 2006. And this is repeating things that we've seen in the Church Committee era, when the courts put restrictions on the use of surveillance, and intelligence agencies simply wrote their way around them. So it's very difficult for courts to, on their own, without the meaningful assistance of Congress, to really constrain executive power.
Of course, it wasn't just intelligence agencies. In our historical part in the book, we talk about the growth of power of the FBI. And there, our wonderful Franklin Roosevelt played a bad role. And there's one decision by the Supreme Court that said they shouldn't be doing wiretapping, and he writes Attorney General Jackson and said, "I'm sure they didn't mean to stop your real wiretapping." You know, so it was a.
He also, as you mentioned earlier, was behind the detention camps of Japanese citizens, something that probably would even shock Americans today. But we were talking about Congress getting involved. When Congress if Congress does pass a law that the president doesn't veto, can he still get around it through a signing statement?
Well, that's a new device that.
Well, it's been around.
It's been around, but it's been used. It's been used by Bush much more than anybody before.
And the real difference is whether the signing statement is simply a "I'm going to follow this law and this is a great law," or whether it's saying "I'm not going to follow this law because I believe that I have the constitutional power not to." That's what's new.
So he signs the law and then offers all sorts of little disclaimers. I can follow it here, but not there.
That's right, and it's really the breadth of those disclaimers. Presidents have always said that there are some laws that trench on their what's called inherent Article 2 powers, but those claims have generally been limited to powers that are listed in Article 2 of the Constitution, which describes the president's authorities. What's different today is that the president is making claims of a new and much, much broader sort that are untethered from the text of Article 2, that are made in the name of national security, executive privilege, and they're sweeping much broader and trenching much more deeply on congressional powers.
Congress has been, in effect, supine in the face of those statements by the president that are pushing away Congress or thumbing his nose at Congress.
But won't that change now that there's a Democratic majority?
Presumably should change now. But another point to make about Democrats and Republicans, these issues shouldn't be partisan. Neither Democrats nor Republicans should like the United States losing its reputation. Neither Democrats nor Republicans should believe that it's a good thing for a president to be able to break the law.
But I don't even understand how this works, Democrats and Republicans, because as I've always understood, Republicans have felt that government should be small, that there should be limits to power, and yet we have a president who ran on that kind of program.
Indeed, talked about a modest or humble foreign policy.
So did they mean that about other things, or were they simply lying, or was George W. Bush thinking something different, at least when he ran for president, than his vice president was thinking?
And then did he get influenced by his vice president? But there are some signs of Republicans being very concerned about these issues. John McCain on torture. A man called Bruce Fein, who was an important person in the Justice Department, who's formed a group of Republicans who are worried about the abuse of liberty by the new Justice Department and the current administration.
I don't think these things break down on clear Republican or Democratic lines. And I think that even within the conservative movement, there's very different senses of what the phrase small government means. For many people, what they're talking about there is really the provision of social services. And they would contrast that with the security services. So what does the government invest in Medicare and Medicaid is a question that's categorically separate from them, from the question of you know, what are we doing with $44 billion that we spent on our 16 intelligence agencies in 2005?
Still, with a very slim majority, the Democrats, if they did want to redress some of these things, would have very little opportunity to do anything. Do you sense that there'll be a time, perhaps in the next administration, when things will change? Because you were talking about permanent changes.
Yeah.
I can't imagine anything is permanent if one of the branches of government doesn't want it to be permanent.
Well, I mean, we wrote this book in part for historical reasons, you know, just to lay out what has actually happened. But we also wrote it to try and help convince the American public that we've gone in a direction which is harmful to our security as well as our liberty. And ultimately, the real issue is what the public thinks, because the courts can't carry the day if the public, you know, they're not going by the election returns, but they can't carry the day if the public's all against them. And Congress is going to be responding to the public. So our hope is that by this book, we help change the debate in the country.
And what's really new and dangerous here is this idea that of an open-ended authority to set aside laws in the name of national security. And the next president, whether they're a Democrat or a Republican, that's a very tempting idea. And it's an idea that is going to have traction. It's an idea that's going to work or not work, depending on whether it has support in the broader public atmosphere. To give a historical example, at the end of the Civil War, we enacted a series of amendments that banned slavery and that restored rights to and deepened rights, not just for African Americans, but for all Americans. And we all know that those were promises, constitutional commitments, that were simply not carried out for 80 years. Why? Because there wasn't the public support for them. And that's a really remarkable thing about American constitutional culture, that at the end of the day, it is a democratic constitutional culture. It's a culture and it's a set of meanings that depend upon what we, the people, believe.
That's, of course, why Franklin, in that wonderful quote that is at the end of our book and that you used, said, it's a republic if you can keep it, meaning the people can keep it.
Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror is published by the New Press, and my great thanks to its authors, Frederick Fritz A.O. Schwartz, Jr., and Aziz Z. Hook, for being our guests today.
Thank you.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.